Mark chapter 9, verse 31. For he was teaching his disciples and telling them, the Son of Man is to be delivered up. And the words we want to focus on are the five words there, is to be delivered up. And we noted that the words translated, is to be delivered up, is the translation of a single Greek word, paradidomi. And the reason for giving you that word is because we want to ask some questions about it, such as, who did the delivery? Into whose hands was he delivered? And some of the particulars that are involved with it. And we begin by noting the fact that is to be delivered is a mistranslation simply because the word paradidomi is in present tense. And he is not saying, I am to be, futuristic idea. He says, I am being delivered. And we noted the reason for that is because the event is so certain that it is described as accomplished. Now, we stopped with the question, Jesus in verse 31 is to be delivered up. And the first question we want to ask, he is to be delivered up by whom? And the answer to that is threefold. Number one, he was delivered into the hands of men by Judas. Mark 14:41. Mark 14:41. By whom was Jesus delivered up? First answer, he was delivered up by Judas. Mark 14:41. And in each one of the passages I go to, we will find the Greek word paradidomi being used. Verse 41. He came the third time and said to them, that is the disciples, are you still sleeping and taking your rest? It is enough. The hour has come. Behold, the Son of Man, paradidomi, is being handed over, or as our translation gives us, is being betrayed. The thing to note is that this is the same word that is used in Mark 9:31 that says the Son of Man is to be delivered into the hands of men. And it is translated here, is being betrayed. And you have in your margin of the New American Standard Version, by the word betrayed, you have the little letter, you have the numeral 2. You go to the margin and notice it says, or delivered up. Same word, paradidomi. The Son of Man is being delivered up into the hands of men. And of course, that's a reference to what is going on with Judas. Judas was the betrayer or the deliverer of the Lord. But it is also equally true, Jesus was delivered by whom? Judas. It is also true that he was delivered, paradidomi, by God the Father. Judas did it. God the Father did it. Romans 8:32. Romans 8:32, we have the note that in the death of Jesus, God the Father was one of those active in it. In verse 32, we have, he who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up, delivered up, paradidomi. Same word as in Mark. But he who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how will he not also with him freely give us all things? So it is true then that God the Father delivered Jesus to the hands of men. But there is a third answer to the question. And that is this, who delivered Jesus over to the hands of men? Jesus himself did. By Judas, by God the Father, finally by Jesus himself. Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians 5. The Ephesians 5 begins by saying, therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children and walk in love, just as Christ also loved you and, next words, gave himself up, paradidomi, gave himself up for us. Same chapter and verse 25. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and paradidomi, gave himself up for her. Jesus was delivered by whom? By Judas, by God the Father, and by Jesus himself. Now that ought to raise a question, and the first question that ought to be raised is there contradiction involved in all three being credited with the giving over of Jesus? And our answer to that will be there is no contradiction, but there is a principle that is involved. All right, next. If we have Jesus was delivered by whom, then we can ask another question. To whom? We've looked at the by whom. Now let's look at the to whom was he delivered. By whom? And now, do we have any specifications as to whom he was delivered? And again, our answer this time involves four entities as to whom he was given. And the four entities are, he was delivered to the hands, we'll list these and get passages. He was delivered to the hands of the Jews. Two, he was delivered to the hands of the Gentiles. Three, he was delivered to the hands of sinners. General classification. Fourth, he was delivered into the hands of Pilate. All right, let's look at each. To the hands of the Jews, and we can handle the first two, to the hands of the Jews and the Gentiles in the same passage. Mark 10, 33. Mark 10, 33. Jesus is speaking, and this is the third time in the book of Mark that he predicts his death, saying, verse 33, behold, we are going to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered up, paradidomi, our same word, to the chief priests and to the scribes. Jesus was delivered then to the hands of the Jews. And they will condemn him to death and will, paradidomi, deliver him to the Gentiles. Notice the transfer here in our minds is that he is delivered to the Jews by Judas. He is delivered by the Jews in turn to the Gentiles. So you have a whole series of causes here, multiple causes that are involved. Then into the hands of sinners, and for that we're looking at Mark 14:41. He came the third time and said to them, are you still sleeping and taking your rest? It is enough. The hour has come. Behold, the Son of Man is being betrayed, paradidomi, into the hands of sinners, Jews, Gentiles, sinners. And if you turn the page to chapter 15 and verse 1, it says, early in the morning, the chief priests and the elders, with the elders and scribes, and the whole council, Sanhedrin, immediately held a consultation, and binding Jesus, they led him away and delivered, paradidomi, him to Pilate. Now, coming out of this, then, is a principle. Looking at by whom he was delivered, and to whom he was delivered, the principle is very important. The events to come, from the perspective of Mark 9, the events to come flow from multiple causes. The events to come flow from multiple causes, all of which are governed by the sovereign plan of God. And the two things to emphasize here are the causes are multiple. They are all under the singular sovereign plan, not plans, plan of God. Now, we have developed previously the idea, and we did it with the life of Joseph just very recently as we surveyed the Old Testament, the fact that in Genesis chapter 45, Joseph faces his brothers and says, you have sold me to Egypt, but God has sent me to Egypt in order to preserve life. So that we emphasize that there was the primary cause of his arrival in Egypt, which was God. Then there was the secondary cause, which was the action of his brothers. And we note that even though their action was sinful, it was for Joseph's good and for the benefit of saving the 12 sons of Israel from starvation. But notice, when we come down here to this event, we have to expand the doctrine of the primary and secondary cause, and in going back to that doctrine, we ought to correct it. Because it's not a matter of primary cause and secondary cause, it should be primary cause and secondary, what's my correction that I needed? Causes, plural. So that God is able to take multiple causes, because remember we noted that from Judas to the Jews, from the Jews to the Gentiles, and thus you've got Judas, Jews, and Gentiles. You've got three causes. They're multiple. And that is saying something bigger than God can simply take a secondary cause and work it for His glory. God can take a whole bunch of them. He can take multiple events and weave them together into something that is the accomplishment of His plan. Now, as a subnote under this principle, we ought to put two other things. The first one is this. The human causes were totally unaware of what they were doing. The human causes were unaware that they were executing God's will. They didn't know that. They didn't need to know. The reason they didn't need to know is what they decided didn't even count. God was so sovereign that He was in control. They were unaware that their actions were part of God's will. Second principle is this. Unknowingly, emphasis on that word, unknowingly, sinners were used by God. Sinners were used by God to bring about the salvation of sinners. Sinners were used by God to bring about the salvation of sinners. Tremendous lesson in the grace of God. Here are sinful men spitting on, putting a crown of thorns on the Son of God, and God is saying, by your sinful act, I'm going to save you. And that is grace piled on top of grace, but that is exactly what happens. All right, going back to Mark 9. Mark 9. First thing we noted then, the Son of Man is to be delivered up into the hands of men. Second item. And they will kill Him. they will kill him. And that's the second prediction that is made that we need to analyze. Number one, let's look at the verb will kill. And the first grammatical thing about it is active voice. That means the subject does the acting or produces the action. Subject does the acting. The subject is they. They will produce the action of putting him to death. The second thing about the word kill is it refers to death by any means. Emphasis, death by any means. It is true that the Roman cross is going to be the means, but it's not in this word. All the disciples knew is that the life of the Lord was going to be taken, and that is the full involvement. The Roman cross is not involved at all. The only thing the Lord wants them to see by the word apopteno is the simple fact that they're going to kill him. Death is going to occur, and that is the lesson that is involved here. The third thing they need to know is when he has been killed. Notice the double emphasis. They will kill him. When he has been killed, he will rise again 3 days later. So notice on the emphasis that he will rise, or the third statement, there is first of all a double stress, a double emphasis that man will kill him. Double emphasis that man will kill him. He tells them that two times. And during all of this, they were so perceptive. We said first session, Peter, what, you know what they're talking about? Peter was saying, I'm greater than you, Andy. And Andy was saying, no, you're not. I'm greater than you, Pete. That was the extent of their conversation. Totally devoid of any understanding of what was going on. And in the face of the fact that the Lord has said he's going to be killed, they are totally self-centered. What this is going to begin to emphasize to us, then, is one word that we need to associate with the suffering of Jesus. Solitary. They didn't join him in understanding, in perception, in sympathy, or anything else. He suffered all alone. And the emphasis will become that on the solitary suffering of Jesus. Also, with the word will rise, it's active voice. And that is the idea, is Jesus will raise himself. Inherent power. And while it is true, elsewhere it talks about God the Father raised him, which is true, it is also true that inherently Jesus raised himself, and that is the teaching at this particular point. Well, notice then the failure of the disciples to understand, and we'll simply caption verse 32, the disciples' confusion. They don't grasp any of it. And the disciples' confusion will give us a couple of lessons. The disciples' failure to understand, coupled with their fear of discussion, points to two things. Verse 32. But they did not understand this statement, and they were afraid to ask him. So the failure to understand, coupled with their fear of discussion, points to two things. Number one, the apprehension of the disciples is very clear. When it says they were afraid to ask him, you have to ask why. Why were they afraid to ask him? I think the reason they were afraid to ask is they were afraid of the answer. You get the feeling that they you know, when he says he is going to be killed, they couldn't have drawn a complete blank. But they could have said in their minds, no thanks, we don't want to hear any more. And therefore, we're not going to ask any more questions because of their apprehension. So I take it that the apprehension of the disciples is at the forefront, And probably part of that is they did not want to discuss the matter because they knew it would be painful. Plus, they weren't in a suffering frame of mind, as verse 34 says. It says, they kept silent, for on the way they had discussed with one another which of them was the greatest. They were not in a suffering frame of mind. Principle. Frame of mind determines what we hear. The potent point. The frame of mind determines what we hear. You say, you mean it is possible to be exposed to teaching and hear nothing? Well, certainly. You can take in your notebook and organize it into notes and type it and memorize it and learn nothing. It's the frame of mind with which we come. And the disciples were not in a suffering frame of mind. And therefore, when the Lord says, I am going to be killed, what did they hear? Nothing. They couldn't hear because of the frame of mind in which they found themselves would not allow. The disciples did not know what they feared to know. See, that's why I never go to the doctor. If there's anything wrong, I don't want to know. That's not a recommendation. So the disciples' confusion reveals their apprehension. But on the other hand, when you see them totally devoid of understanding, it also focuses on the loneliness of Jesus. And there is where we should emphasize an aspect of the suffering of Jesus that is coming into the picture. His suffering was solitary. He suffered greatly, but he also suffered alone. And that is going to come into the picture. Now, since the disciples had been carrying on this little discussion of who is great, the Lord comes on and we can take verses 33 through 37 of Mark 9 and caption them, the subject, true greatness. Mark 9, 33 through 37. Now let me run you through a quickie in answering the question, what is true greatness? And the answer to that, true greatness is the total opposite of everything that man thinks it is. And the way you achieve true greatness is the total opposite of every man, what every man thinks is the way to get there. So what greatness is a total reversal of human opinion, and how to get there is a total reversal of human opinion. So let's divide these verses down into the scene and the context. First, the scene, 9:33a. And they came to Capernaum, and he was in the house. The scene revolves about Capernaum in the house. And the teaching that took place in the house, the scene, extends from verse 33 through 50. So everything now down to the end of Mark chapter 9 is in Capernaum as a city, and it's in a particular house. And in that house, everything that we read from verse 33 clear down through verse 50 is going to take place in that particular house. The whole scene of chapter 9, the teaching in the house, is tied together by catchwords. For example, take the little expression, in my name. That catchword goes throughout the rest of the chapter. Now, if you're looking in an English Bible, notice that verses 33 through 37 form a paragraph. If you're using American Standard Version, the way you tell that is notice that verse 38, the number 38, is boldfaced. And boldface means this is a new paragraph. So we've got two paragraphs of teaching in the house at Capernaum. The first is in 33 through 37. The second paragraph is in 38 down through verse 50. Two paragraphs of teaching. And they're tied together by catchwords. For example, go to chapter 9 and verse 37. Whoever receives one child like this in my name, verse 38, and we're in the second paragraph. John said to him, Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name. And that follows down through. So notice the two paragraphs are tied together by the catchword, which is in my name. That is followed with the context of the teaching. The saying is in the house, the context. And the first part of the context needs to be understood in terms of the social conditions that existed in their day. And notice when you come down to verse 34, this strikes us as really strange. As a matter of fact, I doubt, well, maybe this is the case, but I doubt that you have ever gathered together with a group of, let's say, a dozen friends, and the conversation has drifted around to which of us is the greatest. You ever done that? I've got some little napkins at home, paper napkins that say, please do not talk about yourself. We will do that when you leave. And we generally don't stand around talking about which of us is the greatest. And you kind of look at that and you recoil from us because you say, that's not even good courtesy. Well, this is not very strange. Let me read to you out of a history commenting on life in the Roman Empire, not just among the disciples, but among in the Roman Empire in general. And I'm quoting the historian. He says, at all points in Roman life, in worship, in administration of justice, at meals, in all dealings, there constantly arose the question, who was the greater? And estimating the honor due to each was a task which had constantly to be fulfilled and was felt to be very important. Now, I can illustrate that, I think, very, very easily, and some of you will identify with it and some of you will not. The best illustration of who is the greatest is illustrated very vividly by many, many modern corporations. Is anyone reading me? If you're a vice president, your office is 10 by 12. If you are lower than vice president, your office is 10 by 10. If you are vice president, you get a coffee table and lamp. If you are demoted, you lose your coffee table and lamp. A couple of years ago, I saw that so vividly illustrated at a large corporation, insurance corporation. And I visited a particular person, and they were doing some work in his office, and they were tearing out a wall. And I said, is your office being expanded or changed? He said, no. He said, the office is being restructured to fit my title. And I said, what in the world are you talking about? He says, well, due to travel required on my previous job, I resigned that position. I've been brought down to a lower position, which calls for a 12-inch move in of the wall in my office. And I said, you've got to be kidding. He said, no, that's corporate life. How many? Anyone identify with that? That's the way it works. And you see in many, many major corporations is your furniture, whether or not you get draperies or not, is determined by what you are in the company. Now, that is the context there. And Peter was simply saying, I believe I deserve, as an apostle, the first chosen, I deserve a 10 by 12 office. And Andrew said, so do I deserve a 10 by 12 office. And Peter said, no, you don't. And he gave his reasons why. And this was the context of their conversation here in the context. And it's not so matter of being greater morally or spiritually or intellectually. It's a matter of rank. Where do you fit in the pecking order? So let's put it down in those terms. The disciples were trying to establish among themselves pecking order. You can identify with that, can't you? And to identify pecking order. We have pecking orders in families. If you've got, and I, being an only one, I don't know, there's no brothers and sisters to relate to, but I understand. I always teach this. When we were in Connecticut, talking about Joseph, suffering undeservedly and how his brothers tried to put him to death. And I used to say, if you have brothers and sisters, is there anyone here that has suffered that much that your brother or sister tried to kill you? And I've learned not to do that. That inevitably someone will come up afterwards and say, yes, I had an older sister or brother who literally tried to kill me. And I don't know, I won't ask you because maybe that's the case, but you inevitably can see in a family pecking order. You know, you can almost guess that you're the little kid sister, the youngest of all, because that is established. And this is what the disciples are working at in this particular context. So, the Lord is going to take true greatness and He is going to do two things with it. He is going to give us true greatness. I'll just put TG. True greatness taught. 9:35. True greatness illustrated. 9:36 and 37. First of all, taught. Verse 35. Sitting down, he called the 12 and said to them, if any of you wants to be first, he shall be last, or that can be treated as an order. He is to be, or he must be, last of all, and servant of all. Now, first of all, there's an emphasis here that as strong as the English comes across, the idea of service and servitude comes across even stronger in the Greek text because it reads this way. If anyone wants to be first, of all he shall be last, and of all he shall be servant. So the first thing about true greatness is this, is Jesus' teaching is a total reversal of human ideas on greatness. It is a total reversal of human ideas in several ways. Number one, in terms of what greatness is. And second, in terms of how it is achieved. In terms, first of all, of what greatness is, to man, to be first is to be Lord. To Jesus, to be first is to be servant. And that's a total reversal of human ideas. In terms of how you achieve it, to God, up is down. And that literally blows away all of the ideas from the human standpoint of what we tend to think true greatness is. Total reversal of human ideas. Second, this teaching is a practical application. The idea of serving all is a practical application of Mark 12:31. Mark 12:31 reads, and notice how this is an application of this principle. In Mark 12:31, the Lord speaks and says, the second is this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And in being servant of all, you have a practical application of that. Being servant of all is not only a practical application of Mark 12:31, it is a new affirmation of Mark 8:34. It is a new affirmation of Mark 8:34. What is Mark 8:34? Well, note it. And notice how this principle of serving all affirms this principle. It affirms the principle of self-denial. Chapter 8:34. He summoned the multitude with his disciples and said to them, if anyone wishes to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. And we might note how that stands in such direct contradiction to the thinking of the 20th century. Because if we were to read the popular theology of the 20th century, verse 34 would say, if anyone wishes to come after me, let him discover himself, And while man says, discover yourself, Jesus says, deny yourself. And thus you have a complete contrast, and you have the teaching on the way to greatness is via servanthood. With that, we will have it illustrated, and then the rest of the chapter down through verse 42 will give us some principles that are involved in true servanthood, which we will pick up with in our next study. Father, we're thankful today for your word and your truth. May we recognize that divine viewpoint so often reverses everything that human viewpoint asserts. And may we recognize that what man's conception of greatness is not yours. And the way man tells us to get to greatness is not your path. And therefore, may we respond in this world to your truth and your word and your Son in Christ's name. Amen.